Well, I'm only in a nostalgic mood. I asked myself a very simple question. Who is the infant? Well, of course, I didn't see his face. And someone out, I don't know. But who is the infant who was just redeemed? Of course, I mean, the answer is obvious. The infant who was just redeemed, what's his name, by the way?
Gladysson.
Gladysson. He is the grandson of Rabbi and Mrs. Karasek. Rabbi Karasek, I taught in the late 40s.
Early
40s.
Late
30s. I didn't want to tell the people that you're an old man. In the early 40s, he sat in front of me, I believe, the first row or the second row. First row. He's the grandson of a student of mine. If we should apply the rule, as kolam lamed des ben chaver etero kilo yolode, that the Rebbe is the father of the student, it's a very popular equation in Halacha, we would arrive at a very strange conclusion, and I have arrived at this conclusion, that I am the great-grandfather of the And it is right to be a great-grandfather like Mr. Lachman, Mrs. Lachman, great-grandmother, is a paradoxical experience. As a tweet with sad memories of things gone, the melancholy of retrospection, as well as with the feeling of awe, inspired by the unique generation awareness of the Jew. Let me explain it, what I have in mind. I still have the letter which the grandfather of Rabbi Joseph Karasek, Rabbi Katz, Chaim Broch of San Francisco, wrote to me a week after, let me call it, his first name, Joe was admitted to my class. And the letter began with the following sentence, with the following quotation, rather say, El anar hazeh ispalelti, vayiten li ad Hashem li yeshe yosi asher sha'alti mi'imei. In other words, for this child I prayed. This was written by a grandfather about a grandson. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I asked him. And, of course, he asked me to give special attention to his grandson and guide him as he expressed himself along the path of Torah and Yerushalayim. I still have the letter. From time to time, I've never told the Rabbi Karasek about it, from time to time he would inquire of me about the progress his grandson, beloved grandson, made in my classroom. And there was a special relationship between the grandfather and the grandchild, the grandson. As a matter of fact, it was reciprocal. The grandfather felt the strong love for the grandchild, and Rabbi Karasek felt the same for his grandfather. I know how affected Rabbi Karasek was when the grandfather died. In order to understand this singular relationship between grandfather and grandchild, one must be a grandfather himself. I can tell you, I believe, one thing, namely, wherever this kind of relationship between grandfather and grandchild is established, it transcends as to emotional intensity and intellectual closeness, the parent-child relationship is by far stronger and more intense. The relationship between a grandfather and a grandchild than the relationship between parent and child. If such a relationship was established, I believe, and I take for granted you will not accuse me of being a Jewish chauvinist. I am, but I believe that this unique love of a grandfather for his grandchild is a typically Jewish experience. Psychologically, normally, the concern for the grandchild on the part of the grandparent should not reach the pitch of passion and ecstatic love of the parent for the child, which the parent feels for the child. The greater the discrepancy in years, the great discrepancy in years diminishes the intensity of the commitment. If the situation is different among our people, I know my grandfather had a special relationship with me, famous and high, special relationship. And I reciprocated. I still, when I speak of a prime, it's not just the grandfather. I feel that I was close to him. He died when I was a young boy. As a young boy, I'm still close to him. Somehow he's present wherever I am. If the situation is different among our people, that there is a unique, singular relationship between grandfather and grandchild, it is due to a singular existential awareness, namely the awareness of a Masora community. Let me explain it. We have three patriarchs, you know, Abraham, Jacob, and Isaac. Isaac and Jacob. Somehow our history has bestowed upon Jacob two prerogatives which were denied to Abraham and Isaac. First, the name Jacob or Israel became so-called the generic name or the generic term, the generic name for the people as such. The nation as such is called either Jacob or Israel. Yimono Yisroel K'neilom Chazdei Beis Yaakov L'chu B'neilcho Be'ir Hashem. Abraham, Isaac remained individual names. They have never been apostatized and raised to the level of a collective, generic group names. This is one distinction that somehow was bestowed upon Jacob. There was another distinction which was bestowed upon Jacob. Jacob is always called by the Midrash or the Haggadah, the old man. As a matter of fact, rather reading the Parsha Vayigash, the Bible, so when Joseph inquired about the health of the father, he said, Avichem Hazakim, the old man. As a matter of fact, Jacob was not in terms of biblical age. Jacob was not so old. He lived his life was not, I mean, Abraham and Isaac both transcended him. So past him as far as age is concerned, as longevity is concerned. He's always called Zokin. Omar Lema Zokin, I'm just quoting, I mean, from Midrash, Omar Lema Zokin, Bimokim Shekoseka Zokin, his formation and so forth, around it is countless times. Interesting is something else, that even the Jewish people as such, as a nation, are spoken of as Yisroel Sova, the old Yisroel. It is our nation. The term Yisroel Sova is a very popular one in our Haggadic and Midrashic literature, in the modern Hebrew, you'll hear quite often the term Yisroel Sova, all Yisroel. The question is a simple one. In what manner did Jacob distinguish himself in order to deserve the epithet of Zochim, or in order to deserve that his name was raised to the heights of a generic name, namely the whole people as such is called Jacob or Israel? I believe the answer is a simple one. Jacob established contact and communication between himself and his grandchildren. He was the first patriarch to make the solemn declaration, it's a historical declaration, perhaps this declaration is responsible for the entire Jewish community and for our historical sense of closeness we have to generations gone by. It's a very strange declaration. A declaration has a lot of significance. Namely, Ephraim and Menashe, Keruven and Shimon Hill. Ephraim and Menashe are my children. My children. As Reuven and Shimon. Abraham never said it about Yaakov, that Jacob is like Yitzchak. Yitzchak never said it about Reuven and Shimon. But Reuven and Shimon are to him just like Jacob. But the old man Jacob said it. That Ephraim and Menashe, Keruven and Shimon. As a matter of fact, they took two portions in the land of Israel, as if they had been children of Jacob. He was the first one to impart special blessings to his grandchildren. Amalach Hagir Eisimikol Roy, Yivorech Hasan Roy. Before he even assembled his sons for the purpose of blessing them, he embraced Ephraim and Menashe between his knees. He placed his hand upon their heads. What is it symbolic of? There was direct transmission from Jacob to Ephraim and Menashe. And I believe the famous expression in Talmud, it's not only an expression, it's not just an idiom, it's an halacha. Bnei bonim areim kibonim, grandchildren are like children, is actually due to Jacob's proclamation, Ephraim and Menashe, to Rud Veshimon, really. Isaac and Abraham passed on their covenant, their spiritual heritage, to their sons, not to their grandchildren. The grandchildren received the covenant from their fathers, but there was no direct communication between Abraham and Jacob or between Isaac and Reuven. For Isaac, Reuven and Shimon, the relationship between Isaac and Abraham and their grandchildren was an indirect one. There was a mediator who somehow received from the father and passed it on to his children. The relationship was, I would say, using the existentialist jargon, was I-Thou-He experience. I give to the Thou in order that Thou should give to Him. This was the experience of a relationship of Abraham to Jacob or the relationship of Isaac to Reuven and Shimon. Jacob joined the grandchildren on his own. He needed not interpreters who are closer to the children, who were closer, allegedly closer to the children than he was. He needed no brokers, mediators. He engaged Menashe and Ephraim in a dialogue, in a direct way. He looked over, what shall I say, the gap of generations. He transmitted the great Masorah of Abraham straight to Ephraim and Menashe. even though they were born, raised and educated in a different cultural milieu. And there was a tremendous discrepancy as to age. Nevertheless, the Zokin succeeded in established communication, not with his children, with his grandchildren. The old man taught them directly. As a matter of fact, whoever knows the Midrashim and Vayechi and Vayigash, so Ephraim was the pupil of Jacob. He wasn't the pupil of Joseph. Joseph was too busy. He was prime minister of a great empire. He had no time to teach Ephraim. Jacob did the job. He conversed with them, played with them, dreamt together with them, laughed and danced together. For in order to be a teacher, a rebbe, one has to befriend the Talmud, one has to be his pal, playmate, co-dreamer, and co-searcher. Jacob knew the secret of uniting generations. It's a secret. I know quite a few people can do that. On the other hand, I know many people who are scholars, very intelligent, inspired leaders, but they cannot bridge the gap of generations. He knew the secret of uniting generations, in the secret of intermingling young with old. Jacob discovered that there is a secret language which may combine, unite generations. A secret language which all generations understand and which all generations talk. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Akiva once said, it's another strange Mishle in Elias. I'm not going to interpret the Mishle here. I'll just use one phrase of his. Rav Zecher Ben. בני ובקיח ובאישר ובחוכמו ובשונים ובמספר הדרס והוא הקיץ שנאמר קרא הדרס מריש. The father transmits to his son comeliness. Of course it is a genetic code. Father and son have a common genetic code. When a father wants it and son is ready to accept the code, it's a biological fact. Of course he transmits to the son good looks, strength, wealth, wisdom, and years. Don't you understand? Longevity is a trait of the family. It's a part of the genetic code. But Rav Akiva said it transmits strength, wealth, this is the common economic destiny of father and son, it is a sociological fact, and years, longevity. Longevity depends upon purely biological, physiological factors. This responsible for it is the genetic code. However, he also transmits to the son mispar haderes, the number of generations, the uakeitz, and that is the secret of redemption. Very mysterious word, enigmatic word. The reforcer simply didn't know how to translate this phrase or how to interpret. But Rav Akiva meant that the father also transmits to the son the secret of uniting generations, no matter how much. If a grandfather can establish liaison, communication with a grandson, so a great-grandfather can also do it. Then, the communication lines become endless, boundless. And our hope for redemption is dependent upon the ability of Mispar Haderes. As a matter of fact, I want to tell you, and please don't misinterpret my words. I'm not trying to brag or to boast. I mean, I'm very far from it. But whatever I said now is not just an idea. To me, it's an experience. Let me say that the secret of Miss Praderas, of combining, uniting, merging many generations into one community, where the discrepancy of each disappeared, where years play no role, centuries have no significance, where generations, can, so to say, commune with each other. I do experience every time I enter the classroom at the yeshiva. I've been a teacher for the last, how many years? Oh, you make me very old. Whenever I enter the classroom, which is crowded with boys, it could be, as far as age is concerned, my grandchildren. I enter the classroom as an old man. I am old. With a wrinkled face and eyes reflecting fatigue and the sadness of old age. You have to be old in order to experience that sadness. It's a very strange sadness. It's the melancholy of things, of memory, of remembering things. Things which disappear, don't exist. When I enter a classroom, I sit down, and opposite me, rows of boys, young boys, with beaming eyes, beaming faces, clear eyes, radiating the joy of being young. And always when I enter, I enter in a very pessimistic mood. I always enter the class in despair. And I ask myself, every time I enter the classroom, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and young students? Between a Rebbe in his Indian summer and boys enjoying the spring of their lives? I start here. I don't know what the conclusion will be. Whenever I start a shiur, the door opens, another old man walks in and sits down. He is older than I am. Oh, the Talmudim call me the Rab. He's older than the Rab. He is the grandfather of the Rab. His name is Reb Chaim Brisker. Without whom, no shiur can be really nowadays. Then the door opens quietly again, and another old man comes in. He's older than Reb Chaim. He lived in the 17th century. What's his name? Shabtai Cohen. He's the famous Shach, who must be present when Dina Mamanes are being discussed when we study about Mitzvah, about the coming. And then more visitors show up. Some of the visitors lived in the 11th century, some in the 12th century, some in the 13th century, some lived in antiquity. Rabbi Akiva, Rashi, Rabbi Netam, the Ravid, the Rashbo, more and more tapir coming. Of course, what do? I introduce them to my pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam says something, the Ravid disagrees. Sometimes it's very nasty. But very sharp. Half language he uses against the Rambam. The boy jumps up to defend the Rambam against the Rambam. And the boys fresh?
You know, these boys are, young boys are fresh. Say,
the language he uses is improper. He uses improper language. So I correct him. And another boy jumps up with a new idea. The Rajbo smiles gently. I try to analyze what the young boy meant. Another boy intervenes. We call upon the Rabbi Netam to express his opinion, and suddenly, a symposium of generations comes into existence. Generations! Young boys, 22, 23, 24 years of age, our boys who are just 80 years old are in my class. One generation, then my generation, then the generation of Rabbi Chaim Brisker, then the generation of the Shah, then the generation of the Rashbo, the Rambam, the generation of the Rambam, the generation of Rashi, the generation of the Rabbi Netam, and then, I mean, there is no end. What about Rabbi Haibel? What about Rabbi Kibin, Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Yechon, the Zaka? All generations somehow are... We all speak one language. Batikol oretz sofa achas sudvorim achorim. We all chat, we all laugh, we all enjoy the company, and we all pursue one goal. We all are committed to a common vision, and we all operate in the same categories. There is Masero collegiality, friendship, comradeship between old and young, between antiquity, middle ages, and modern times, the decades, this unity of generations, this march of centuries, this conversation of generations, this dialogue between antiquity and present, will finally bring the redemption of the Jew. Because what is the Jew's commitment to Eretz Israel? If the gap with separate generations, and if generations couldn't have communed with each other, and if generations couldn't have communicated with each other, why should the American Jew who was born in New York or in Boston or in Portland, Maine, who never saw Eretz Israel, who never heard very little about Eretz Israel, I mean, the public school did not tell him anything about Eretz Israel. Why should he be committed to Eretz Israel? Who told it to him? Who told it to him? His English teacher? His gym teacher? Who told him? Who told it to the Jew in America? That there is some way, far away beyond the Atlantic, on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, which he has it pulling somehow, which pulls the Jew like a magnet. Who told it to him? Who told it to him? The generations who lived in Eretz Israel 1900 years ago, before the Jew was exiled from Eretz Israel. I mean, does the American Jew have communication with Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai? These believers of Masada? The settlers, no. If the American Jew had no communications, to no communication with Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai and the heroes of Masada, and all the Jews who fought and fell, and in the field of battle, in defense of their country, in defense of the Bishamidish, in defense of Jerusalem, if they are silent, so how does the American Jew know the secret of Eretz Israel? Apparently there is a silent communication. Silent, but yet quiet communication, communications can be established. The means of communicating is not always the word. Sometimes silence is the best medium of communication. This is the great dialogue of generations, which is responsible for the Jewish commitment to Masere, the Jewish commitment to Eretz Israel, for the Jewish commitment to survival, to self-survival, the Jewish commitment to a great eschatological vision. Let me tell you that at the conclusion of 3 and sometimes 4 hours, I mean, I have here a witness. I met Jung and waited. Younger than my pupils. We are tired, exhausted, some of them young. I feel happy. I have defeated age. I have defeated oldness. I emerged young, less fatigued, less exhausted than my young pupils. As I stated before, I watched Pina Ben with nostalgia and a joy and a joyous reverence. I stood in awe before the repetition of the great miracle of the rendezvous of generations, the Frauen und Naschek Rum Rishinoyeri. I see Rabbi Karasik, young and handsome, I mean, I don't know, no, but I liked him, sitting in front of me, trying to evaluate the new teacher, concentrated and sometimes very skeptical. And now I see to my left Mark, and I don't know whether it is 1945 or it is 1973-74. I am communicating with another generation. Is my pupil, and he is as close to me as his father was, and he is, and perhaps closer to me. He is, what I say, my God. I don't move without it. And I want to apologize to Mrs. Karasik. Believe me, I don't take away your husband. I send him home every time. I throw him out of the house. I tell him, don't, I'll take care of myself. You help your wife and me. And take care of your baby. But there is something strange about our relationship. Not only the time the Rebbe and his the Talmud. This itself would not be so enigmatic. We talk together. We exchange observations, impressions. At times, I find myself confiding in him. An old man confiding in a young boy. The discrepancy in years is tremendous, and at times I feel uneasy. However, we act in the spirit of Yaakov Avinu, who extended the hand of cordiality and comradeship. We belong to the same Masora community, where generations meet, where hands, no matter how wrinkled and parchment dry in one hand is, and how soft and warm the other hand is, shake, unite. And in a community where the great dialogue continues, when I was looking at the baby, was redeemed this evening. I don't know whether he'll be in my place, whether I live to have him, but someone will sit and teach the baby. And the baby is already a member of the community, of the great Masora community. And I feel as if I it is possible to establish communication with this baby. Now, I want to say just a few words. To Mark and what's your first name, I don't know? Linda. Linda. I mentioned the verse which your great grandfather quoted in his letter to me at the time when your father was promoted to my class. The first three words and an hour as there is for longer. You know of the quotation, from where this quotation is taken? From Hannah. We read the after, this is after, the first day of Rosh Hashanah. And I believe that another day is phalanthropy, we may find the whole philosophy of Pidgin Aben. This boy I wanted, well, let me just repeat the sentence. This boy I wanted. I prayed for him. Without him, my life would have been senseless, bleak and lonely. You know very well how much Hannah wanted the boy, the son. Hannah is portrayed as the mother par excellence who wants a child, who is unhappy without a child. The urge is so strong, is so overpowering, that Hannah considers her life meaningless without a child. You'll ask me why those women want a child. Why is the urge so powerful? Simple. Because men and women want not only to be loved, but also to give love. To have somebody for whose sake she could sacrifice herself. The Hannah mit der Teresa Libo. So Chazal say, Al Iski Libo. She was praying for her heart. The heart was ready to pour love, unlimited love, and devotion upon somebody, upon a child. The heart felt frustrated. There was no one whom to love. Of course, and this is here typically Jewish, what I'm going to say, the more a man longs for something, the more claim the Almighty lays to the objective when the latter is finally achieved. If you want it so much, if you waited for it in prayer and tense expectation for a long time, is the need, the need for which you have waited so long, for which you have prayed so long, is not yours, but mine, the Almighty says to me. The more you love him, the more he belongs to me. The more you pray for him, the stronger my claim of ownership is. And the more the longer you waited for him, the less right you have to own him. You have no right to enjoy it. It's all mine. Hannah waited so long for Shmuel to arrive. Hence, Shmuel did not belong to her. She knows very well. But to the Almighty. Hannah formulated it beautifully. The whole philosophy of child-parent relationship. She said the following. ולנער הזה הספלותי, ויתן נד שמש שאילוסי אשר שואלתי, many days and many years she kept on praying. וגם עונך היא אישותי זלד השם, כל היום עם אשר הויו, שון היא לד השם. But this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I have asked of him, Therefore, because I want it, I want Shmuel to be with him. I want him, I own him, he's my property, I own him, I'll talk to him, I'll raise him. I'll educate him, I'll give him everything which he'll need. Yes, but honey, arrived a separate, so at another conclusion, which I've asked, and the Lord has granted me my petition which I ask of him. Therefore, it doesn't belong to me. A strange conclusion. It is almost irrational. This is magic.
because I expected it from him, because I longed for it, because I prayed for it, because I am ready to sacrifice everything I have for you. Because of all that, the child belongs to me. And Hannah has reached the reverse conclusion. Because I expected a child, because I longed for him so long, because I prayed, because I'm so happy, because I'm ready to give him all the love in the world, therefore the child doesn't belong to me. I have also lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he is lent to the Lord. Of course, you love your first child. I'm sad. Life has assumed another dimension with the birth of this little boy. The mere presence of the infant in your home is a source of enormous joy. I know that. However, the more you love your baby, the stronger are the ownership rights on the part of the Almighty concerning your baby. And the baby belongs to him, not him. However, the Torah has never been clear. The Torah has devised a method how to buy the baby from the Almighty, how to purchase the baby from the Almighty, how to acquire the baby, which by right belongs to him, capital H. The Torah recommended that the parent purchase the baby from the Almighty. Acquire the child. It's an act of acquisition. Picking up them is an act of acquisition. I mean, I don't know whether people listened to the conversation between the Cain and the father. It's a very strange conversation. It's enigmatic from an halachic viewpoint. As a matter of fact, my grandfather, Reb Chaim, has never said it. He never permitted people to engage in such a conversation. But the conversation goes back to the truth of the beginning. There was much more. It was short and abbreviated. Yes. A strange conversation. But Cain asked the father, what do you want? You want the baby? Or you want the 5 bucks? And the father, of course, answered, he would like to give the $5 for the baby. But this conversation is symbolic of our philosophy. The baby doesn't belong to the father. Putting in halachic terms means acquisition, selling, purchasing. And usually putting means purchasing not from another human being, but from the Maker, from the Creator, from the Almighty. The acquisition of something sacred. God is willing to give the child to his parents, not to give away the child, but to give the child to his parents. They should enjoy and love it, and the parents pays for it. How much? How much is it worth? Is such a baby worth? What would you say? No appraiser can determine the price, since the baby is priceless. There is no equivalent value which one could give for the baby, which could match the worth of the baby. So what did the Torah do? It's an act of purchasing. If you purchase, you pay. There is no purchase, no sales transaction without paying the price. The father is not capable of paying the price for the baby, not even the greatest. Not the billionaire can pay. Not the whole world cannot pay price for a little baby. So what do you do? You know the idea of what a dollar a year man. What does it mean, a dollar a year man? When do you hire a man for a dollar a year? Then he doesn't need your salary. He's rich himself. He doesn't have to make a living. So if you hire a man in order to justify from a juridic viewpoint, the hiring, I mean, the contract, you're writing it's a dollar a year. The $5 are like a dollar a year, man. You haven't, still, you don't have the money to pay for the baby. So pay me little, as much as you can.
$5.
You pay almost nothing. You give the $5 as a symbol, and you acquire the baby. Now the baby is yours. You may derive pleasure and joy from the baby, endless pleasure and endless joy. However, that sales transaction is a conditional one. Father and mother, when they buy the baby from the Almighty, assume responsibility. What do you mean, responsibility? For his physical well-being, more than that. Responsibility as far as the community, the Masora community is concerned. It is yours for one purpose only, namely to join the Masora community and to mingle with the generations on their eternal march. And I'm pretty sure, knowing Robert Rossi and Mrs. Cross, Mr. and Mrs. Watman, knowing Martin, I know him well now. He's a wonderful boy. I'm just not trying to flatter him. I'm very sincere about it. Knowing Martin, that they'll meet all terms of the agreement. And meeting the terms of the agreement, you'll derive nachas, endless nachas, and happiness. And you take together the grandfather, the grandmother, the great grandfather.